Hello, I'm Jean-Philippe Renou, and today we will meet the residents for the second and final time. We pick up the story with Homer Flynn, the resident's official spokesman, who explains the origin of the group's mythology, a mythology that was built on disguise, dissimulation, and even labelled under the theory of obscurity.
Theory of obscurity says that an artist does their best work, or his best work, her best work, when they are completely obscure, when no one knows who they are. And the idea of this is that, you know, once an artist becomes known by their audience, then the audience starts putting demands upon the artist, and it's impossible for the artist not to become influenced by these demands. And so their purest work comes when they're the most obscure and the least known and influenced by their audience. And the residents really worked under this theory for quite a bit during the first few years. But after a while, you know, they started to have reviews in Rolling Stone and the British Music Press, and at that point they realized that they no longer were obscure in that same way, and so the theory of obscurity no longer worked for them.
Skinner was born in a bathtub and grew so incredibly thin that even the end of an eyedropper sucked him in. Now Skinner never knew any questions, and Skinner never looked at lights, but Skinner sold something every single night.
My name is Francis Falsetto. In France, I'd invited the residents in June 83. They were a quite large team traveling in a bus, so it was difficult to say this one is resident, that one is a resident. It was absolutely forbidden, even for my organization, to go into the dressing rooms, for instance. You know, that it was, I mean, extremely well protected. But the funny thing is, many of my friends of the time, all of them super fans of the resident, were taking picture of each and everybody leaving the bus, going into the theater, you know. They were taking picture of the bus, saying, this is the bus of the resident. Even to see the bus was exciting for them and for us, you know. I mean, we were playing the game of the resident.
It's a funny game that the resident play, a game of appearances and disappearances. Their most famous disguise is the eyeball, a gigantic eyeball mask with a top hat and underneath a tuxedo. Here is Homer on how the eyeball became the icon of the group.
The idea of the eyeball came in, it came for the Eskimo album. And I think that was 1979. So the residents, originally what they wanted to do was have a different image, a different faceless image, anonymous image for each new album. And if you go back and you look in the 70s, you'll see all these different images. You see the newspaper suits, and you see radiation suits, and, you know, you see shadowy heads that look like boxes, and, you know, things like that. So that's what they were doing initially. When it came time for Eskimo, they wanted something really special.
Rings and feet are fair.
Initially, the idea of the eyeball was something kind of like a giant ball that was like silver, like a giant silver ball, and with a top hat on that. And the problem with that was that when I talked to costume people, they said that it was very difficult to build this and make it so that it wouldn't steam up on the inside. You know, people would need to be able to see and hear, and it would get condensation on the inside, and it really wouldn't work very well. And so then that giant silver ball became a giant eyeball, which means you could have a hole in the center of it where people could look out, and that worked much better. I found some people in Los Angeles that were working on a TV program that was kind of a Star Wars ripoff called Battlestar Galactica. And those were the people that made the original eyeballs. And then actually the same people were, we actually met those people again later working up at ILM, George Lucas place. And so the same person made new eyeballs in about 1994, 95. And they're, you know, it's a better design. I mean, he actually improved on it.
Something's going on between them, something I can see. Nobody seems to pay attention, so it's up to me. They're always touching, always looking in a secret way.
What happened was that one of the eyeballs was stolen from backstage at a club in Los Angeles, and I think it was around Christmas 1985. And it was a situation where the dressing rooms backstage were separate from the green room where you see people backstage, and someone managed to sneak in into the green room and then into the dressing rooms, and then this person went up a stairway and went into another dressing room up above and dropped the eyeball out the window into a big garbage debris box, and then just walked out of the theater and took it and went home with it. And the residents were so outraged that someone would actually steal their icon, their precious icon, their symbol, that they decided that it would there would never be four again. That was the end of that. And so the one whose eyeball was stolen then became a black skull, because that one was in mourning the loss of the eyeball. And eventually the eyeball did come back. Supposedly the story was that someone stole it from that person. You know, the stolen eyeball was stolen and returned to the residence. Whether that's the truth or whether that person felt guilty and wouldn't actually cop to what happened, I don't know. But anyway, they do have the stolen one back again, but the resident who wore that eyeball would never wear it again. You know, it had been violated, and so the skull just continued.
Whatever explanation Homer Flynn may have, the rumor-mongers say that the introduction of Mr. Skull simply signified the death of a member of the residence. We will never know the true story behind the missing eyeball. And we will probably never know the true story behind the Eskimo recording either. But once again, the residents' self-created mythology, or need for mythology, is more powerful. And according to Homer, somehow linked with an unknown ethnomusicologist, the mysterious Nigel Sinada.
You know, they had an association with the mysterious Ensenada, and he left and felt that there was some great mysterious link to modern music through Eskimo culture or something like that. And so he went off to explore Eskimo culture, and a few months after that, some tapes showed up that were supposedly from him to the residents. And, you know, in listening to these tapes, they became very inspired. Not so much to recreate the tapes, but to recreate the feeling that they found in those tapes. You know, a feeling of another culture, or a feeling of a very strange alien space. They became fascinated with the idea of Eskimo stories because, you know, they don't have as much written language, so the whole culture is passed down verbally from one person to another, and Eskimo stories are a big part of the culture. So the idea of recreating some of these stories, but purely with sound. So they had to find stories or write stories that they felt were true to the Eskimo culture, but we're not depending upon the spoken word in order to be able to tell the story. And that was one of the really hard parts for him. The mysterious Ensenada also had a theory called phonetic organization, which had to do with creating music based on vocal sounds. And I think a lot of the Eskimo vocals were based on this theory of phonetic organization.
It's ironic that one of the most iconoclastic one ever has created such a powerful mythology surrounding itself and have become avant-garde rock icon for more than two generations of devoted fans.
Residents have definitely been known to stretch the truth a little bit. They like to put the truth in its best light.
Everything you say to me today is true?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That was Omer Flynn speaking on behalf of the residents, and this is the only official recording interview they have ever given. Oh, that is what they told me.